would like to introduce our next speaker, Hrivoje Chargonja. Hrivoje comes from Croatia. He completed his undergraduate and his master's in Zagreb, and is now working at a PhD, also based in Zagreb, in anthropology, and working as a research assistant for the Institute of Anthropological Research. He is currently spending 2 years researching in Oxford under this program, working with Gavin Flood at the UCHS. And his work particularly is on the topic of religious experience in the Hare Krishna movement. So,
there you go.
Thank you, Kumar Kriya. We have heard a lot about conversion today. I hope I can make a little contribution to our discussion with an example from my research and to see how really conversion looks in the field. I will present you with several case stories and present you several topics that arose during the narrative analysis of the conversion stories that I gathered in Zagreb among the temple communities, among the members of the temple community in Zagreb. But before we take off into the stories of conversion, I would like to introduce you to the setting of the object of my study, and that is namely Croatia and Iskon in Croatia, because it is against this influences that we will discuss the topics that arose in the conversion stories. So, short about Croatia, for those of you who are still wondering where that tiny tract of land still is, it's just across the Adriatic Sea on the other side of the Italian wood. It has 4.5 million inhabitants. It declared independence from Yugoslavia and socialist rule in 1991. What followed afterwards was a war over territory against Yugoslav army, and which was in the hand of the Serbian leadership. The war was fueled by national conflicts as well that were smoldering in the deeper layers of history from before, 100 years even before. So the fighting stopped somewhere in 1995, and after a slow recovery, the economy finally picked up, especially after 2000, with the help of tourism and foreign investments, and today Croatia is a candidate to become the member of the European Union in 2012. However, aftermaths of war and massive transition to private ownership left deep marks on the Croatian society. Only the last government that we now have has mustered enough strength to deal with corruption and other troublesome issues of Croatian society. So, now I would like to talk about the religious freedom in Croatia and in the context of Eastern Europe. James D. Richardson, in his 1997 article on religious freedom in Eastern Europe, explains that there are two significant patterns in the way religious freedoms in the area develop. One is represented by Poland, and the other by Hungary. In Poland, the Catholic Church was strengthened by the strengthened in the communism by the figure of a Polish Pope, John Paul II, and became a channel of the opposition to the regime. After transition, the church maintained strong influence on the state and hindered development of legislation that was conducive to religious plurality. In Hungary, it was quite the opposite. The Catholic Church suffered more from the regime, and it was not so strong to overcome socialist legacy of secularism. Croatia followed this Polish pattern of transition. Church in Croatia was strong because the socialist regime was not so oppressive as in the countries behind the Iron Curtain. Former Yugoslavia, to which Croatia belonged to, was the founder of the non-aligned movement and had more open variation of socialist tyranny, I would say. With regard to this religious freedom, Croatian sociologists talk about two periods in the recent history. Secularizing forces of socialist regime were dominant up until the 80s, when collapse of communism in former Yugoslavia, like in all Eastern European countries, promoted revitalization of traditional religious culture. According to census from 2001, 88% of Croats are Catholics. Religion intertwined with nationalist sentiments, like in Poland, has a considerable influence on the state. So, and now I will tell you something about ISKCON in Croatia. The beginnings of Hare Krishna movement in Croatia go back to late 70s, when several devotees, mostly from Germany, started paying occasional visits to what was then the former Yugoslavia. In 1997, the first Hare Krishna book was translated into Croatian. 1977, I'm sorry. The key figure spreading the movement in the area was Hare Krishna Swami, who would soon become guru of the majority of devotees in Yugoslavia and Croatia. The first devotees were mainly young, educated people who spoke English well enough to read the literature. Socialist regime at the time wasn't too much of a hassle, so they started their preaching in Zagreb with only minor unpleasant encounters with the regime. The movement was officially registered in 1983. Thriving community moved around Zagreb several times, accommodating its needs for growth, and in 1985, a temple in a village nearby Zagreb was established. Remaining operational until 1993, it was the most important Hare Krishna center in the region, from where Krishna consciousness was spread to the other parts of former Yugoslavia. Great expansion of the Hare Krishna movement in Croatia started during the 90s. Atmosphere of civil war that was raging in Croatia in these years helped to fill the ranks with new young members. In 1990s, it was estimated by a community leader that there were 25 active monks, while in 1996 there were 250 temple residents that lived across Croatia. Several festivals held from 1992 to 1996 were visited by thousands of people. This gave the movement publicity significant enough to provoke minor negative reactions in the media from the dominant Catholic establishment. Until around 1996, the movement mainly operated as temple community. Over the past years, the number of active members who got married and had children increased. Many realized that austere temple conditions could not accommodate the needs of many families. This first wave of devotees instigated the growth of the secular counterpart. Additional influence was the influx of new members who wanted to start practicing Krishna consciousness but in a less demanding way. Like older Eastern chapters around the world, initiatives were launched in Croatia to address the needs of rising congregations like Namahatta programs, house gatherings, bhakti sanghas, and so on. Disagreements in the leadership between temple and growing congregational members, mismanagement and financial controversies, especially regarding temple construction in Zagreb, were some of the major challenges that the movement faced from 1996 to 1998. Final blow came in 1998 when Hare Krishna Swami left ISKCON. The fact that at the time he was the guru of almost all the leaders of the community suggests to the extent of the crisis into which the movement in Croatia was plunged into. Temples and centers in several towns were closed, membership declined, with estimates of around 30 temple residents altogether in 2001 as compared to 250 just a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, right? Trying to build the temple, Zagreb ISKCON was on the constant move from 1998 until 2002, when the present building was finally acquired. Through several following years of struggle, new leadership structure emerged and was backed up by congregational members who are now able to offer support. In 2005, the first festival was celebrated in the new temple, which had an integrative effect on the community. Today, Hare Krishnas in Croatia have installed deities in three major Croatian cities and have smaller centers in seven other towns. Estimates from leadership are that there are about 25 temple residents and about 300 active congregational members throughout Croatia. So, before we continue, I would just like to introduce you, get a brief overview of the theories of religious conversion. So, in all academic discussion, religious conversion is always defined as a religious change. It is what, with regard to the nature and the origin of this change, that the theories of conversion differ. There are two main scholarly approaches to the religious conversion: sociological, that emphasize external influences and tend to see human beings as passive sufferers of external forces, usually disregarding human agency. The other approach is psychological, that tends to see conversion as a transformative event that men undergo in isolation from historical influences. In the last decade, especially among anthropologists, there has been an initiative to merge these aspects when presenting the complexity and the meaning of conversion. My views subscribe to these holistic tendencies presented in the collection of paper edited by Brookser and Glasier, The Anthropology of Religious Conversion. In my presentation, I will, however, use another model of conversion developed by one of the contemporary authorities on the field. Although published in 1985, Louis Rambo's model of conversion, interesting name, Rambo, is still an esteemed point of reference. Rambo's model builds on a gradual model developed by Stark and Laughlin, sociologists in the 60s. He strives to take into account both the individual and both the individual experience and the historical circumstances. For Rambo, conversion is an ongoing process of religious change that takes place in a dynamic force field of people, events, ideologies, institutions, expectations, and experiences. This force field, according to Rambo, is regarded as a matrix of religious change. Rambo's model involves 7 stages of conversion: context, crisis, quest, encounter, interaction, commitment, and consequences. Now, I will not go in detail what each of these stages mean, but let's just say that context is an overall environment in which change takes place. Crisis stage represents tensions of internal or external origin that call into question a person's taken for granted world. Quest stage allows how people respond to that crisis. Encounter is the contact between the potential convert and the advocate of new alternative. Interaction is an intensification of the process, actually a stage where one learns about new tradition. In commitment stage, a person makes a decision to devote one's life to a new spiritual orientation. And finally, consequence is an aspect that tries to assess how affected is convert's life and how comprehensive these changes are. Rambo is adamant that his model does not represent a linear succession of phases of conversion. His stages can overlap and repeat in a back and forth movement. Also, his context and consequence stages could hardly be understood as a particular periods of time in one's life. How is a context a phase, right? So therefore, in my opinion, it is better to talk about aspects of conversion in his terms, where some of them may or may not have this, I say, temporal designation. So before I start pointing out the distinguishing features of conversion narratives in Croatian Islam, I have to say that understanding conversion in Croatia is impossible without talking about the conversion of Islam in Croatia. If conversion process depends on the historical circumstances, then it is possible to detect these influences in the stories of conversion. This is the basic rationale behind my research. Islam in Croatia exists for more than 30 years now. All devotees will agree that being Hare Krishna up until mid-90s meant to live in a temple. As we saw before, shift from monastic to congregational buildup of community changed that. If what it means to be member of Hare Krishna changed, then the process of becoming Hare Krishna had to change too. The forces that were behind this shift pushed individual members outside the shelter of a communal economy. After sometimes more than a decade of temple life, many members had to begin anew in a hostile world of karmas. Devotees struggled in their adaptations to life out there in Maya, and many failed to maintain the standards of spiritual practice. With rising controversies in Islam, many looked for spiritual shelters elsewhere. On account of that, arose a spectrum of practitioners with various levels of dedication and understanding of what it means to be a devotee of Krishna. Apart from these, the more intrinsic forces that were brewing inside Croatian Islam, conversion narratives point also to the higher order of social influence. These motivations originate beyond the borders of community. One good illustration can be found in the conversion reports of devotees who joined the movement in the 90s. They will remember concerts of Goranga Bhajan band. This was especially popular music band at the time. Its members were devotees, and its concerts attracted thousands of visitors in Zagreb and several other cities of former Yugoslavia. The sheer magnitude in terms of attendance of these events can surely be held up accountable for promoting conversion. It is because of this fact that a lot of them who joined the movement in the 90s will find important to report these concerts in their conversion stories. Reasons why these concerts were so visited by wider public in Croatia are to be found in a wider setting in which Zagreb community was situated. First half of the 90s are marked by the war in Croatia. These conditions created a level of general insecurity that initiated search for meaning in many citizens. Motives of many newcomers in the 90s can be connected with these overarching currents in society. As Hare Krishna movement in Croatia shifted to its congregational phase, the context in which devotees interact has also changed. House programs, bhakti sanghas, workshops, retreats, the whole counseling and chaplaincy segment evolving. On the example of ISKCON in US, Burke Rochford explains this in his book Hare Krishna Transformed, that the emphasis brought by transformation was now on keeping the existing devotees rather than on recruitment of the new ones. As it will be discussed further, the conversion stories of newcomers in this changing movement differ from the stories of their predecessors. This is particularly evident in the attitudes of older devotees who sometimes complain about the situation in present ISKCON and think fondly of the days when conditions were harsh, but the enthusiasm was at its peak. Many narratives reveal their uneasiness with the fact that contemporary ISKCON is not what they initially converted to. So now I would like to tell you a short story about Madayanti, one of my informants. As we like to call them in anthropology, in anthropology, informants, that's the name. At the time of the interview a year ago, Madayanti was 40. She joined the movement when she was 20 years old. That was in 1989. She was already a young single mother of a four-year-old girl trying to make a living. Madayanti was part of that rare bunch of devotees who were a congregation when there was none. For 4 years, she would travel to the temple for morning and evening programs and before and after work because she wanted to be initiated like everyone else. She had to wait 7 years for her initiation. Here is a passage that on my presentation that captures her struggle really good. She's telling how she felt when she began more seriously interacting with the movement. And then fighting started with material energy. At that time, I was not mature enough to be a grown-up, a woman, a devotee. I was not yet a devotee. I felt inferior because I couldn't live in the temple. I couldn't live in the temple because I had an obligation. I had a child. And the thing I wanted to do the most is to leave everything and join the temple. I was very miserable because I felt unqualified to be living in a temple. So everything became a burden for me. So in another citation from her interview, she goes, that was all lost time for me. I just didn't know how to balance myself, and preaching was like that too. You need to let go. You need to surrender. People were coming in the temple in huge numbers. I chose a very strict spiritual master. He didn't give initiations to the people who didn't live in the temple. And to be eligible, I had to be eligible and get the recommendation. Nobody told me that I had to quit my job. I just had to come for the morning and evening lectures. I have really, really, I can say that here in front of Krishna, in front of the altar, I really made big efforts, huge sacrifices, energy. I asked myself, where did I get my energy? I had a job, and after I would go almost every day to the temple. Then the kid, homework, cooking. As the interview further reveals, Madayanti is trying to rationalize her attitude toward good old days in terms of her own private struggle as a single mother, years of loneliness, and the one unsuccessful romantic engagement with a devotee. She was also honest to admit her remorse for the effect of such dedication on her daughter, who often ended up being left out because of Madayanti's unrelenting excuse, mother has to chant. There is, however, another side of these harsh old days for Madayanti. In the following passage, she's showing us how she felt comforted by her religion, which helped her to cope through her own existential stress. I have such experience that long time had to pass before I could look back and see how dots are connected, how Krishna directed events. Because when I was in situation, I didn't see Krishna in that situation. I didn't see that he's directing something, that he cares. But when the situation repeats 3-4 times, like with some of my anxieties, how will I get a job? I went through several jobs and I was often struggling to make ends meet. And then after 5th time, you finally realize, no, I don't worry anymore. Krishna arranged it. And that time, and this time, and then suddenly that was my first realization that I no longer worry how to make ends meet. This is what came first. I stopped worrying, what will I eat, how will I do this, how will I do that? Because Krishna has always taken care of me. It's just that in these first years, I was very restless. Before we go on, I would also like to mention Larry Shin, that Kumari Priya was mentioning in the lecture before, and his distinction between the process and the decision, between conversion process and conversion decision. I think that can kind of a little bit explain the discussion that was going on after Kumari Priya's lecture. So in his 1989 article on conversion, on conversion in ISKCON, Larry Shin points out how making a commitment or a conversion decision is different from conversion process itself. In other words, conversion is a process that begins before contact with devotees, whereas conversion decision is just part of that process. It's a moment when devotee consciously increases her or his or her commitment. Looking at when and why decision happened in the ongoing conversion process, Shin noticed 2 main groups of conversion accounts. In the first one, conscious commitment is made after devotee becomes well acquainted with the tradition. In the other, decision to surrender was made before new member could acquire a well-informed view of tradition. Shin also points out that the search for meaning is the common denominator in motives across all his cases. By relying on the work of Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, he maintains that this search for meaning is one of the primary driving forces in human psyche. Shin has collected his interviews in early 80s on the eve of major changes that will occur in Hare Krishna movement. This could be a reason why Shin does not discuss how change within particular ISKCON communities shapes the individual process of becoming Hare Krishna. Nevertheless, Shin's evaluation of psychological approaches to conversion concludes that the theories of conversion are like shadows in a Plato's cave. They distort and reduce reality. This notable distinction between process and decision in conversion has been very useful for me. It helped me to establish the connection between change in ISKCON and change in the patterns of individual conversion process. As I have stated before, I would like to argue that the place of decision in the conversion process is a function of historical conditions in the community and the society the community belongs to. Analysis of conversion stories showed that these narratives could be grouped according to the presence and the position of the temple phase in devotees' biographies. In other words, narratives of conversion can be grouped according to whether or not devotee lived in a temple and according to how much time had to pass to make this commitment. Results of such parsing of the interviews showed how devotees who joined the movement in the transitional years have their own temple phase delayed for several years. On the other hand, among devotees who joined earlier in the 80s and 90s, did so usually within 1 year of their initial contact with Hare Krishna, as Larry Shin points out. There are, of course, devotees who joined the movement in these early years but never lived in the temple. Such cases of this early congregation, like aforementioned Madayanti, are, however, rare. As it was revealed by Madayanti's words, the position of devotees like her during these early years was somewhat undermined in community. However, when the tides of change swept the movement in the 90s, those devotees were easier to go through this transformation due to their own financial independence. Position of the temple phase in the individual narrative of conversion is directly linked to the overarching transformation of the Zagreb community. This conversion in ISKCON, thus conversion in ISKCON reflected directly the conversion of ISKCON. As the pattern of commitment changed, so did decisions about the surrender and temple life too. Rising congregation informed devotees about the troubles of adapting to life outside the temple. Newcomers became more wary about their decision to forsake the outside world. Another crucial element that still bears a distinguishing mark for ISKCON conversion in Croatia is the Sankirtan, or proselytizing activity, primarily through book distribution. For devotees joining the movement up until mid-90s, Sankirtan was primary means of sustenance. But for most devotees, it was by far much more. In his book Religious Experience, Wayne Proudfoot noticed how proselytizing activity in new religious movements is often a method for conversion. This is certainly true for ISKCON. Sankirtan became a training ground for practicing new identity. It was a way to expose oneself to a certain degree of existential uncertainty in order to start noticing the hand of God and basically practice surrender and this new worldview. Here is a quotation from a devotee who is a distinguished member of the temple community in Zagreb. He spent his first 8 years as a devotee in Sankirtan in the 90s. The transcript grabs the joy that many devotees found in Sankirtan, an activity that could be strenuous and even dangerous at the times. Books picked up. I distributed 17 books that day and somehow it became my love. I had unbelievably wonderful experiences, how people completely uninterested suddenly became interested. You see that these things happen outside material nature, that has nothing to do with salesmanship, with your charm, with your ability to speak. You are just an observer of something beautiful, a mailman who observes how books find their buyers. As the controversies of misuse of funds still linger about the community, the leadership of Zagreb Temple today is more lenient about pushing resident devotees into Sankirtan and claiming rights on the share of their incomes. Being no longer the primary means of sustenance for the community, book distribution was no longer so demanded by temple management. However, for those devotees who still go in Sankirtan, it seems that it still offers the same rewards as before. Following the insightful words from one younger devotee who joined the temple in 2000. These are his words. He talks about changes in the identity he would experience in these Sankirtan outings. What both previous and the following accounts share is in common is the theme of practicing detachment and surrender that is so important in Vaishnava theology. I had also interesting experiences in Sankirtan, in book distribution, when I would free myself from the mind due to this desire to surrender to Krishna more and more and to give to the people this what I have received. I had experiences when, as if some other person entered inside me. I know that sometimes in the elevator I would look in the mirror to check if this is still me. I would lose myself of identity, me as myself. I would turn into some other person because I would joke with the people. I would do things, speak things that are simply not in line with my character. Simply total transformation. Whenever this happened, people would buy many books. Another observation about conversion narratives is that in them there are usually two significant turning points. Relating to Rambo's terms, they could be called crisis phase. They are significant because they represent a culmination of tensions caused initially by either internal or external forces. These tensions result in considerably different orientation in life. The first turning point is in most cases connected with search for the meaning. In devotees who join the movement in their late teens and early 20s, this is usually a part of what is also known as adolescent crisis. Here is a quotation from one devotee that gives us a sketch of these adolescent ruminations. When I was 17, I started going out like a normal young people, clubbing and stuff. And every time I would come back with the same experience of emptiness, that was most spiritual experience for me when I would look at the stars, sky and think, God, is there something that is permanent happiness? In fact, that was my daily question. Quest for meaning may be pre-existing, but it might just as well be induced by the contact with the Hare Krishna. Second momentous point in the conversion narrative is connected with unresolved tensions that accumulated during beginning years of enthusiastic involvement with the movement. It is usually connected with background existential issues and demands that oftentimes originate outside the religious community. In some ways, during this second turning point, devotee will change the way he or she sees the community and his own position in it. For many devotees, the fall down of their guru and the upheaval that followed was such a turning point. It should be noted that there are stories where devotees have gone through more than just two turning points, like we shall see in the following case story. It is just that these two could be detected in the stories of the most interviewed devotees. The last actor that I want to introduce into my narrative today is Vasudev. His case is a representative of devotees who joined in early years, went through conversion to householder life, and now are coming back to live in the temple again. He mentions his own example, how he started reading Hare Krishna literature only because the girl he liked was impressed with another guy who had read these books. Vasudev thought that his chances to win the girl's favor will be higher if he starts spending more time with this guy and read the stuff he does. His plan with the girl didn't work out, but he ended up learning about Krishna consciousness. Army duty and several years of study at the university made him forget about it for a while. When he finally meets devotees, he becomes profoundly influenced by the existential questions provoked in him by deeper reading of Hare Krishna books. He abandons his studies and moves to the temple abruptly. He was 44 when I interviewed him a year ago. He joined the temple in 1989 and was 24 years old. As we can see from his words, his decision to commit himself to temple life was sudden and radical. It was connected with religious experience he had the night before he left, when he chanted in the park in his hometown. I cried as I chanted, and I felt as if I am flying, as if when I walk, I'm not touching the ground. Of course, I did walk on the ground, but I walked and walked for about 150 meters. I was moving up and down among the trees, and I felt as if I am not part of this world. I knew then, Maha Mantra gave me enough inspiration, and as if it opened one box of unknown things for me. It showed me that the world I live in is not the place where I belong. And it was as if I felt that I'm not this body, but spirit soul. And I was very happy that I wasn't this body. And then, after such realization, all material things became insubstantial for me, and I very easily left behind all my attachments. He literally packed his things, and the next morning he took off for the temple in Pragya in the 1980s. After a year in temple, he travels to Hare Krishna community in Sweden, where he meets his guru and becomes initiated. Vasudev traveled to India and spent a lot of time living abroad. He was married for 8 years, most of which he lived as a part of rising congregation in Iskon community in Ireland. It is here that his personal transition from monastic life happened. His third turning point in life was caused by divorce, which he interpreted as Krishna's arrangement. He claims that it allowed him more time to do what he really likes, preaching. Vasudev put on saffron robes again, returned to Croatia, wrote two books with devotional thematic, and became a welcome guest in Eastern communities across former Yugoslavia. After the very end of our interview, Vasudev will find important to tell me one little story that also belongs to his story of how he came to be a devotee. At his birth, his mother had a vision of Virgin Mary, telling her that her yet unborn child is going to be special. Curiously enough, the event did not inspire Vasudev's mother to divert from her atheistic views, but as Vasudev hopes, it might have helped her to understand her son better when he started following his spiritual calling. In the first part of the discussion, I have tried to address the social aspects of conversion, social topics that arose in the conversion narratives, by giving examples how conversion in ISKCON is inseparable from conversion of ISKCON. As we have talked about in the introduction, explaining conversion by external influences belongs to sociological approaches. In this second part, I would also like to address more intimate and private aspects of conversion, like religious experience. Religious experience is a concept whose definition depends on what we mean by religious and experience separately. Thus, Wayne Proudfoot talks about implicit causality hidden in the term religious experience. Due to the lack of time and my intention to keep focus on conversion, I will not present you here with various definitions and extensive discussions that this term implies. I thought that today we might just focus on the data more. Therefore, I will just give you my working definition of religious experience, which I think fits my data the best. I would like to make here an accent that this is really a working definition. So, religious experience, as I came to understand it through the interviews, is that it is an extraordinary event, or in the religious terms, structured memory of or narrative of it. The extraordinariness of such experience is partly derived from a certain degree of conviction that the event itself is constituted or influenced by the order of existence that transcends naturalistic causality. In terms of Vaishnava theology, in my understanding, and I would be happy if we could discuss later about this, religious experience is, in my view, some kind of an actualization of a relationship with God, or a relationship with God made present. So, as for the corresponding term in the language of ISKCON, I became convinced that the most befitting translation of the term religious experience would be a realization. I came to realize that realization, in a more narrow sense, means insight. A moment when theological interpretations can directly explain immediate circumstances. On the other hand, realization can also designate the story of Krishna's arrangements and mystical experiences, like ecstatic feelings during chanting or kirtan. In my research thus far, I have detected three types of the stories of religious experience: insights as realizations in the narrow sense, and are the first and the most readily talked about. Second are Krishna's arrangements, or stories about line of events considered to be arranged by Krishna. And finally, event experiences are the stories about a particular event that includes an episode of some sort of altered state of consciousness. When I asked devotees to tell me how they came to be members of Hare Krishna, always had at least one segment that was regarded as direct Krishna's involvement. These religious experiences occur in all of the Rambha's phases of conversion, but most of them belong to the interactional phase of conversion. This means that the religious experiences told as part of conversion narrative are in some reinforcing relationship by the process of learning about their religious tradition. In many cases, religious experiences during conversion are reported as the most memorable ones. They are usually related to the quest for meaning, and in more than 50% of the cases are in connection with Guru. As for the meaning, the narratives described to these events, all devotees will claim that experiences strengthen their faith in Krishna. Religious experience gives them emotional conviction and reinforces their motivation. From a more cognitive perspective, religious experience could be seen as a discovery in the process of learning tradition. In this view, religious experiences are moments when believers are turned into knowers, as one anthropologist suggests, when theoretical knowledge about tradition becomes more tangible, more applicable, more real. As the analysis of the religious experiences in conversion indicate, Guru and the process of choosing Guru is yet another feature of ISKCON conversion that all devotees have dealt or have to deal with. Such significant number of religious experiences in connection with Guru indicates the huge importance Guru plays in devotional lives. But this is not so only for the conversion. Of all analyzed stories of religious experience, by far the biggest proportion of these reports is in some connection with Guru. Also, just to remind, for many devotees in Croatia, Guru is implicated with a second turning point in their lives. Guru is one of the subjects that have been studied in ISKCON, and due to the complexity, I would not like to dwell on it further. Another topic arising from narratives that I will also just like to briefly mention is, I call it ritual identity. One of my first impressions of what Hare Krishna movement, of the Hare Krishna movement that I jotted down in my notebook, was my amazement with the quantity of ritualized practice in a daily life. When a friend of mine was telling me about her daily life, it seemed to me as if her whole day was one big ritual. Deity worship, chanting, saris and dhotis, and all that syncretic Hare Krishna outfit and fashion, even food rituals, toilet procedure, initiations, and many more. There are all distinctive marks of ritual identity, and they overlap to some degree with all other themes in conversion narrative. Both guru and ritual identity underwent changes during Iskan's transformation to congregational build-up. Without going into deeper analysis, I want to point out that today there is a bigger emphasis on chanting and improvement of interpersonal relationships disturbed during the process of transformation. Very popular in Croatia are so-called japa retreats and summer camps with seminars on the issues that enable devotees to deepen their understanding and practice of their faith. Stories about Krishna's arrangement confirm that reconfigurations of memory and personal history around new organizing center is the common trait of all conversion stories I analyze. The goal of Gaudiya Conversion Project is to see everything in relationship with Krishna. As you can learn from Vasudeva's conversion narrative, a devotee we discussed before, reflecting back on his past to recognize God's fingerprints, becomes an ongoing forensic endeavor. Namely, Vasudeva, if you can remember, included even his birth in his story of conversion. This leads us directly to yet another feature of conversion. Conversion in ISKCON is continuous passage. One does not become a devotee of the Lord overnight. Looking through the glasses of Vaishnava cosmology, it is a process that started many life cycles ago and is still going on. That's why, in my opinion, many devotees see their conversion like an upgrade of the previous religious engagements rather than like a break with them. These previous religious affiliations are not seen so much as dead ends that have to be renounced, but more like a byways that roughly lead in the same direction. It is exactly this inclusiveness that represents the last hallmark of ISKCON conversion in Croatia that I want to point out today. Consequences of these inclusive attitudes can be seen in conversion narratives as descriptions of activities, practices, and even experiences that might look like some sort of syncretic imagination. I have witnessed that in their homes, many devotees, especially former Catholics, will often keep displayed pictures of Virgin Mary, some Christian saint, or the crucifix. Sometimes this Christian imaginarium was even a part of house altars and accompanied deities and pictures of gurus and other Vaishnava saints. Some devotees reported going to chant in the church or even attending masses of some inspiring local Catholic preacher. I should make clear that I don't think that devotees actually invented a new tradition that is a syncretism of Christianity and Vaishnavism. Far from that, my claim is that conversion narratives show that under the umbrella of inclusivist theology, devotees feel a certain degree of freedom to take part in other religious realities. A contributor to the book that I mentioned on the beginning, on anthropology of religious conversion, Diane Austin Bruce, defines conversion as a process of continual embedding in the forms of social practice and belief, in ritual dispositions and somatic experience. The accent on this continual embedding renders conversion as neither breach from previous affiliation nor syncretism of old and new traditions. Conversion is seen as an ongoing passage that arrives at certain habitus rather than a utopia. Interestingly enough, utopia means no place in translation. Habitus is a term that Pierre Bourdieu, if I pronounce this well, developed, inspired by concepts of bodily techniques developed by Marcel Mauss. Habitus is basically a system of dispositions of lasting, a system of dispositions or lasting acquired schemes of thoughts, perception, and action. In other words, they are patterns of how we think, see, and act. Religious habitus is then more than just a collection of beliefs and practices. It is an embodiment of religious ideology where bodily practices are connected with the states of consciousness, like bowing down, putting on a tilak, dhoti, chanting, and many other and more intricate rules, verbal responses, gestures, and postures that converts have to absorb and engender in their behavior. These schemes of thought, these embodied practices, they are organized in some hierarchical but overlapping clusters in our fluid identity. For example, devotees bow down or prostrate themselves and utter mantras when they encounter a sannyasi and especially their guru. Their faces, verbal reactions, and body language will suggest openness, humility, and obedience. All these practices are connected, sustained, and made meaningful by memories and emotions of past events connected with guru, and knowledge and citations from the scriptures connected with guru and authority. Thus, there is a complex of these dispositions, a habitus within the habitus, connected with the topic of guru. All these connections between various actions, gestures, performances, and expressions, and their interrelatedness with thoughts, memories, and feelings, all that had to be learned. They are all acquired in the process of conversion. They are actually what devotee gets converted to. Most of these things happen without special instruction. People learn these things mostly by imitating others. However, not all elements of religious habitus are equally important. Some activities are preferred over the others. Time and attention invested in learning some of them will be bigger than for the others. For example, singing and dancing are not so important as the chanting on a daily basis. Almost all devotees, when they enter a temple, will pay obeisances, but not all of them will ring a bell. And so on. We could think of many examples like that. What devotees report in their interviews, when they tell conversion stories, is what they feel it is important or convenient to say. Conversion stories are in that regard especially revealing about religious habitus. They reveal these topics of importance which give us an idea of what the new members become converted to, what conversion means for them, and how that changed through time. As we have seen throughout this lecture, during the period of change in the Croatian ISKCON, the meaning of these topics changed, and accordingly their presence in conversion narratives as themes. Temple phase delayed in devotees who joined in the later years, diminished book distribution, existential crisis induced by congregational shift, relationship with guru, etc. Relationships of importance and power included in fluidity of this habitus were influenced by the wider social movements and limitations in the society. All together, they shape a new understanding of conversion process. So, in a way, talking about conversion stories is actually talking about what most people say when they talk about their conversion. So, in the end, how do all these topics that I have just pointed out define conversion in Croatian ISKCON? By using them, I could try to summarize our previous talk with the following. Conversion in Croatian ISKCON is a continuous passage, seen usually as an upgrade with regard to previous religious affiliation. It involves a certain degree of ritualization of everyday life and practices like chanting, deity worship, distinctive dressing, appearance, and food taboos. Most devotees who joined before 1996 have spent a year or more living in a temple, either as a celibate or married. Sankirtan is an important practice in conversion through preaching and book distribution, with diminished importance with regard to earlier years. Search for meaning is the main motive for conversion, but many devotees have a second turning point in their story when Hare Krishna Swami left ISKCON. Guru is the strongest axis of authority and, together with initiation, plays a crucial role in integrating a devotee into community. Guru is implied in most reports of religious experience in conversion. There are almost always passages with religious experience in conversion report, and conversion story is mostly regarded as Krishna's arrangement or a religious experience itself. So we have come to the end. I hope that the arrangement of previous passages managed to give you a sketch, an overview of what conversion in Zagreb ISKCON is, and how it was affected by the change in community and in the wider society. Well, I guess in any such attempt, reductions are unavoidable. The whole process of narrative analysis is, well, in a way, a process of reduction and developing categories within the categories. So, but I guess these exceptions, they all prove rule that the free will is unavoidable and actually never quite graspable concept in humanities and by any theories. So thank you very much for your attention. I hope I wasn't too ambitious. I had a hard time parsing the answers. Questions? Yeah, I didn't want you to say that there is a one member present in the audience. Yeah.
But I didn't quite catch what point you were making with respect to it. You said something about conversion will be reflective of what's going on outside and inside the movement. And then you were saying why this was so successful because of what was going on in Croatia.
Right.
You mentioned the war.
Yeah.
I was just curious what you were saying.
I just wanted to say that conversion narratives from the people who joined during the 90s, they always mentioned concerts of Goranga Bajan band. That was really important for them. And these concerts happened, and these concerts had such an impact on their lives because they were visited by so many people. And they were visited by so many people because the social conditions in Croatia were such at the times. Mm.
Okay. And you also mentioned Larry Shin's distinction between process and decision, and that this distinction was helpful for you, but I wasn't quite clear how it was helpful for you.
Okay. The moment of decision is the moment when the devotee is committed, either to the temple life or finally decided to get an initiation. When I started analyzing my interviews in that way to locate the conversion decision, I noticed actually that there is a difference between between the temple phase. There is a difference when the temple phase happened in the devotees that joined the movement in the 80s with regard to those that joined the movement later. So. Yes. To actually claim that the conversion in Croatia is inseparable from conversion of Iskon, right? That had to be viewed in that context.
Okay. And just maybe a comment, appreciating this point about process as being continual. I was thinking about this in my previous talk also. With respect to narratives in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that there are these many narratives of what we might call conversion of particular people, but I wonder if one could also think of the whole story, which is about Chaitanya's life, as a conversion narrative which is continual, especially the end of his life. He is going into these extremely intense states, and it's like each one is more intense than the next one, and it's almost like each one is a profound transformation, and there's mention of him sometimes coming out of the states of trance or whatever and lamenting that I'm just making a show, actually I don't have any devotion for Krishna, sort of thing. Suggesting that the picture that Krishnadas is giving is that yes, the real conversion is without beginning, without end, considering the theology of eternality of the Atman and so on, which maybe is a way of breaking out of this joyful Christ that Gaudiya mentions. I don't know, I just think about it. But I appreciate that you notice that this is an understanding meaningful in this context.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was actually thinking about this vicious circle that we were talking about after Kumari Priya's lecture, and this is what I want to evoke Larry Shin again, to make this distinction between the process and the decision, where we can see, you know, each devotee, when talks about how he came to be a Hare Krishna member, he will tell the story in a way that everything in his life led to this point. So in that sense, if you know, conversion process started, as we could see from the Vasudev story, at his birth, you know, when Virgin Mary told his mother that he's going to be special, you know, and this is how it goes. So I guess the exit from this vicious circle is that in this moment of this decision that we analyze when the moment of decision happened, and then we can talk about the conditions around the moment of decision and so on. So maybe in my own view, this looks like an exit from this circle we were talking about.
Thank you very much for your well-prepared presentation. I was just curious that in your interviews of these devotees, because you discussed that this conversion as a sort of ongoing process, mm-hmm. I mean, this Vasudeva case, it started from his birth, mm-hmm. but then there was like a certain moment or certain event mm-hmm. which was crucial in his or her conversion mm-hmm. into mm-hmm. Christians. Mm-hmm. And in that, I'm just curious, to what extent did the meeting with devotees or meeting with gurus or meeting with sadhu was important? The reason I ask this, as opposed to, for example, receiving books, mm-hmm. yeah. The reason I ask this is because Baladeva has a commentary on Brahma Sutra, and he has discussion on Atta in Atta the Brahma Jivyasa, and this discussion is that the whole Vedantic interest is, so Atta means then, but then it means there was something before. But then something happened which led someone to mm-hmm. get into Brahma Jivyasa, which is quest for the ultimate reality. Mm-hmm. So there's a big sort of ongoing dynamic discussion as to what qualifies or what makes someone to get into this search of ultimate reality. Mm-hmm. And in contrast to Shankara or Ramanuja or Yudhimatha, Baladeva emphasized this very clearly, that what is crucial is sadhu sangha, mm-hmm. that the meeting with someone that who carries the seed of devotion. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of Baladeva's distinct contribution into Vedantic discourse from Gaudiya perspective. But that's discussion, but in your actual mm-hmm. research, I'm just curious how
Well, I would say that conversion decision is always facilitated by encounter. You know, you cannot, of course, that would be illogical. You cannot convert to a community or become a member of a community without meeting a member. And so that is always there. But a conversion process may start from many different reasons and motivations, I would say. You know, as we can see on Vasudev's story, you know, he learned about Krishna consciousness for all the wrong reasons, right? Because of the girl. And then later on, actually, when he met devotees, then the, you know, existential questions and search for the meanings ensued, and he started, you know, going deeper, and then he had religious experience, and that pushed him to make a final decision. But there are other stories. I mean, there are other motivations why people go. The most prevalent one is the search for meaning. I mean, most stories are stories of people who have had some soul searching, you know, before they actually met the devotees, you know. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was just interested in that in your interviews about conversion, you also included people who are not part of Krishna movement and Krishna anymore. Uh-huh. Because the framing would perhaps, it seems, provide interesting
clues. Yeah. I really thank you for this question, because in preparation for this this presentation, I was really, really thinking about whether to include the story of one apostate, actually, for many reasons. One of which was that this ex-devotee, she's now a devout Catholic again. I wanted to see how she felt about her religious experiences before. And actually, I wanted to kind of organize my presentation by talking about the people, person who left the movement, since Hare Krishna community in Croatia is marked by, I would say, many people coming and going, you know, there's not many people who stayed over the years, many people just kind of went through the movement. And, she was one of them, although she was the old member for 10 years. So yeah, I did interview devotees like that, and, especially devotees, you know, now in ISKCON, in Croatia, and I believe this is throughout the world, you have many different levels of practices and beliefs, many different understandings, actually, what does it mean to be a devotee of Krishna. So many people in Croatia have diverted and started reading books from other Vaishnava lines, or have their own interpretation. Many people have their own views on how to regard their guru who fell down, you know, which is completely not in line with what we would say orthodoxy in ISKCON things, you know. So yeah, there are these, I mean, I included these variations, but mostly members.
And do they provide any, clues as to, do they still talk about their conversion experiences as arrangements of Krishna, or do they actually...
Okay, for me, when I was doing the research, I really wanted to find a person who will tell me that, you know, who will renounce completely a Krishna consciousness, and that was really hard to find in Croatia. Actually, as far as I know, this is the only devotee that I met who will say, no, Krishna is not God. All the experiences I had, that were delusions. You know, most of them, from the interviews I got, they just kind of moved on, but they built upon their experiences from the Hare Krishna movement. You know, so for them, the break is not so distinct. And I think with regard to this devotee's situation, you know, she converted back to Christianity, and Christianity is very, you know, very firm about, you know, what does it mean, what you should renounce, or what you should do, what you should not do, how you should think or feel. There is just no place for, you know, image of blue-eyed dancing God in Christianity, and, you know, you cannot say that Krishna is God, so. Although, I must say, in the interviews with her, she was, you know, if you would have a transcript here, you would also see it. She was not, you know, very firm about it. She was, like, not really straightforward about her answer. Yeah.
Very nice presentation.
Thank you.
One of the fastest presentations of this conference.
Really? No, I was so... I was so...
But I was just saying that this may not be at all relevant to your work. In one sense, because in the Western context. But is there an argument, because you discussed about your methodology and then you use, you know, this person's theory, etc. But we've kind of heard in other presentations that Western theories uninformed Western theories of Eastern religious practices can be uninformed. And is there a case for you or somebody else in some future study maybe developing a different model, a different methodology, a different approach? Because we can get any methodology, and I remember some scholar came from America to Ireland to do the Irish F and Myers Briggs method, and it's just so limited that when everyone got the results, it was kind of no one recognized themselves anyway, so it was just some academic thing that someone understood what it was, but let's move on. But I'm just saying, is there a case to look at different methodologies, because methodologies that you spoke about, I found it certainly interesting, and certainly with any paradigm, any data, but
As far as these theories of conversion to totality, I really find, in my own view, this reader on anthropology of religious conversion is really encompassing and accommodating for study of conversion in Islam, as far as my opinion goes. But I would also like to make another point in what you are saying. You see, Islam is not really completely anymore Eastern tradition. It's a transplant. Devotees in the West, especially in Croatia, are people who are conditioned and who have lived in that cultural setting. And I think there was a lecture today on that. And they are accommodating all these new things in their life in some substratum or some underlying current of their which is mostly, as we see, Catholic religious background. So in that sense, Western theories could be more accommodating for ISKCON than it would be for study of the Vaishnavas directly in India. You know what I mean? But I to tell you the truth, I don't. Well, there's always room for improvement, of course, but so far I'm kind of satisfied with what I have encountered. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You mentioned something about the attitudes of these people towards their previous religion, namely the Catholic faith, and you said something that it wasn't a syncretism, but rather sort of I forget what the word.
It was not. It's not a syncretism nor a breach.
Okay.
It's a passage. That's the theory of that anthropologist. But because many devotees do. Still have keep the, some connections with their previous religious affiliation. I think we even talked about, and there was this, somebody mentioned this story about devotee doing puja to Virgin Mary in the Catholic Church. You were telling me about this. So it's obviously that some level of syncretism, especially on the level of practice, is happening. But this is far from being, like a whole new tradition. It's definitely still Vaishnavism, just with some kind of syncretic additions to it, which don't really make it so different from their original form. So yeah, basically, what I noticed there that conversion in ISKCON is not that. It's not a fusing of elements of two different religious traditions, nor it's breaking with the previous affiliations. People were more lenient about their understandings of Christianity and even Islam. There are some devotees who come from that background.
The reason I asked is because I can think of people I know that are members of ISKCON that are initiated and so on, who who I would say have created some form of syncretism between genders. I'm thinking of Belgium, my home country, where it's, let's say, syncretism of Catholicism and sort of Chaitanya Vaishnavism. And it's sort of not just in terms of practice, like the story I told you of the devotee going into the church, lighting a candle, and then waving it around the Virgin Mary as if he's doing puja to her. But also in terms of theology, where sort of not just in one way, where Jesus' teachings and the Bible is read from a Vaishnava point of view, but where the influence also goes the other way, where certain sort of Gaudiya ideas have, to me at least, a very distinct Catholic ring to it. Their understanding is sort of a very Catholic ring to it. That others, who come from a Catholic background do not have. I'm not saying that every sort of person is like that I know. But there are definitely cases like that.
Well, you see, there are things like that, but they are not what you would call, or what the community would call, as an active members. You know, in these processes that happened after Hare Krishna Swami left ISKCON and so on, there are many things that happened, among which was one form of, it is actually a form of Christian Vaishnavism, that one devotee that, he renounced, he stepped away from the movement and started building his own organization that were founded on some kind of understandings or misunderstandings or whatever between Vaishnavism and Christianity, like playing football with Krishna and so on. I mean, which was, and something like that. Yeah, but they were, and at one point they were quite popular, and they even attracted some of the figures of Croatian public life even. But as far as I know, in these days they are not really so active. Yeah, but he proclaimed himself to be a guru. I think even he said that he's an incarnation of Radharani or something. I mean, I would have to look into it. But yeah, there are things like that.
I want to go back to Shankar's suggestion about developing sort of different model of, or different theory of conversion or even about religion, because we also saw what conversion means in, and how that means in different ways, in different contexts, in Kumar Duryodhana's representation. And I think the one problem here is that, of course, as long as we communicate in English, we have to always think about where terms like religion and conversion and experience comes from, namely, so Judeo-Christian background we have to take into consideration. But at the same time, after doing that, I think we can sort of reclaim or sort of produce our own definition of religion or our own definition of conversion. And I think that's quite possible. And the reason I say this, and the reason I see it's very much necessary, is, for example, like yesterday, Gopinath Acharya was talking about what faith means. And for example, if faith means faith in certain dogma or certain statement, then you cannot, in other words, being in Christian faith is exclusive to being Muslim faith, for example. Yeah, so because if you say to be Christian means to have faith in Jesus as the only way, then unless you accept that statement, right, you cannot be Christian. If you assume, whereas if faith means faith in certain activity, then you can be doing one activity according to one tradition, but some other time you can be doing some other activity according to other tradition. And for example, I come from Japan, and I my family is Buddhist, mm-hmm. right? So when I go back to Japan, and I, of course, my father, when my father asked me to accompany him to temple to propitiate my ancestor, I would go, mm-hmm. and then I would do whatever he asked me to do, you know, sit in front of the Buddha deity, and you know, do certain ritual, mm-hmm. right? But at the same time, in terms of practice, I also chant at the same time, right? So, in terms of practice, I can be Buddhist and Hare Krishna at the same time. So, and there's this famous census in Japan that when they ask, okay, so how many people are how many Japanese people are Buddhist and how many Japanese think they're Shintos? And then when they put up the number, the number of the Japanese population suddenly doubled. You know what I mean? So in other words, many people didn't feel it was a problem to take two boxes or even three boxes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think we really have to think sort of or redefine what these terms mean in our tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You mean in a particular example? Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think that we can reach to some universal definition of conversion. You know, all these models, like this Rambo model, all of these models of sociologists, and so they can help us to start with something and then accommodate and view whether these phases are, you know, how they work in a particular material, you know. And well, they always work to some extent, you know, and you always have to adapt them to the material you are actually researching. I mean, I guess there is a difference. You know, I'm working with interviews with people basically, you know, and that also, you know, what you get there might to some degree differ from what you get in the literature and the scriptures, right? So that's also to be taken into consideration when defining what conversion in ISKCON means. And I think we should, when we talk about conversion in ISKCON, we should always keep in mind that this is not Gaudiya completely anymore, especially when it comes down to the practice, to the level of people, because these people, you know, ISKCON are made of people who are not, who did not grow up in Vaishnava culture. Yeah, so it immediately makes it a completely different setting and background. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do we have time for one more quick one?
In your research, did you find any issue with separating genuine stories from sensationalized stories or narratives? Mm-hmm. And I say that for the reason that perhaps when an outsider, a scholar, or somebody other would ask perhaps a Hare Krishna of their story of conversion, mm-hmm. then perhaps their own spiritual credibility may depend for them upon a good story. Then the credibility of the religion or that they've joined will depend upon perhaps convincing you mm-hmm. of a good story. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, because I think that, and having been part of or being led into what was called a preaching mission and where every moment was encouraged in that direction for many, many years. One of the greatest opportunities in an attempted conversion was when finally a person would turn to you and say, so how did you become a Hare Krishna? And then, you know, that was the opportunity knocking on the door to convert another by my conversion story, which was rather filled out with, you know, a lot of material other than perhaps what was essentially there. So, you know, a kind of personal preaching strategy in that. So did you find that with the devotees of Croatia, that they may have been attempting to convert you and tell their conversion stories?
Yeah, actually, I mean, this is one of the troubles that I had from the beginning. You know, it was this preaching discourse that I would always be engaged with devotees. You know, that was obviously interview. Many of them regarded this interview a chance to preach to me, and that's why many of the interviews would last for hours. And so, yeah, because you know, after they told me all the verses from Bhagavatam and so on, then I could finally ask the question. You know, what did your parents think about your coming to the movement? Yeah, so yeah, that was I noticed that. But as far as religious experiences themselves, I would say that people are suspicious of their religious experiences. You know, in the end, nobody will. I mean, there were people that were, you know, when they told the story about religious experience, they were really sure about it. But you know, when you start talking about how do you know that this is true, and so on, you will see that people have their own reservations and their own questions about whether this is true, but what if this is just a product of my mind. And another point is that I've noticed that this is what one devotee pointed out to me, that you know, it seems that religious experiences have this effect that when they are happening, you are sure of them. But you know, as the time goes by, you start to doubt whether what happened was really true. So yeah, this is present.
Well, thank you very much, Vibhori, for your presentation.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.